Hello and welcome to episode 42 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And this week, we continue the beautiful story that Nishant shared with us last week. For those of you who are just tuning in, last week we interviewed Nishant Joshi of Alt Cricket. Nishant is a full-time doctor who has written his own book, hosted his own cricket TV shows, and even built his alternative cricket brand on the internet all by himself.
The first part of this interview depicts a very honest picture of failure and the success that comes along with it through hard work, honesty, and resilience. So if you're just joining us this week, do go back to episode 41 to see just where we left off. But as for now, let's not wait any longer to complete Nishant Joshi's story, where we promise this time there are less tears.
So you already mentioned something that I could really relate to, which is that when children mess up, parents kind of say that, oh, it's the university's fault. It's that one professor's fault. It's they're being racist or whatever. It's very common. I'm not the only one who can relate to this. I'm sure of it. A lot of, maybe Meenal doesn't, because Meenal's parents are quite different, because they have like, they have a very different value system. They would probably question their kids first, but
they would probably definitely blame me.
Yeah. So a lot of other parents out there are definitely the kind that would say, oh, no, we know that you made a mistake, but the convenient option for us is to blame the third party. We already know that this is how your parents reacted, but was there, when you were going through the Soviet Union phase where you saw Czech Republic,
you know,
for the first time,
makes,
you were saying,
when Nishant makes Tears of Nishant Joshi, can there be a chapter called Soviet Union? My face.
Soviet Union, yeah. And you were seeing everything in black and white. I'm really curious to know how your dad, who had watched a documentary and sent his prince off to this prestigious school, I want to know how he was seeing it too. Was it black and white for him too? Was he disappointed in the place? How did your parents react to everything?
I think they were naturally a little bit upset to see their son going abroad, away from the family home. One of their kids going outside UK was never in the plan. And that's a line that my dad says, this was never part of our plan. And I feel that for him especially, it was a very prescriptive sort of, if I do this, then this will happen, this will happen, this will happen. If I work hard, then this will happen, this will happen, this will happen. There was no sense of preparing for the worst. Well, there was, but not in this way, because I think my dad had already felt that he'd endured the worst. Because, again, this is quite important to understand everything. That my father, coming from Uganda in 1972, he came as a 17-year-old. And essentially what happened is, for those who don't know, is a very important part of British culture, in fact, not just Desi culture, but all of the Indian immigrants in Uganda were kicked out. And many were murdered as well by Idi Amin, the Ugandan dictator, in 1972. So what happened is that they said, you have 100 days to leave Uganda. All of your land, all of your property, all of your wealth. Obviously, some people manage to smuggle things out and whatnot, but you have to leave in 100 days. So there became a mass exodus. And because it was a British colony, I don't know why at the time, because I can't imagine anything similar happening now. But the Queen and the government decided, okay, well, we're going to accept these immigrants here. Now that I talk about it, I don't actually know why. But they accepted all of the Indian immigrants there. So I think it was something ridiculous, like 100,000 Indians, maybe a bit more even. And my dad left there age 17. And he thought, on the way to the airport, he told his father, so my granddad, who I never got to meet, but my granddad told my father on the way to the airport, son, I know you think that you're coming back, but this return ticket is only for show. This is a one-way ticket. Because I think they had to do something with immigration to show that he was coming back to the country or something like that. Some administrative magicianry had happened, and my dad had a return ticket instead of just a one-way ticket. My dad thought he was going for a holiday to see if he liked the idea of living in the UK. But just with one suitcase, he was sent there all by himself. First time going abroad, he went to England all by himself. And so he would always tell me stories about how shit the conditions were in UK when he came there in 1972.
Wait, isn't this similar to what you went through then, you could say? You both kind of lived the same, through the same experience. Is that what you were getting to? Sorry.
Some may tell this the art of storytelling, Meenal. so, yeah. again, this does loop back on itself. And this is why it's so curious and it's so interesting to see that things are being repeated on different planes generation after generation. Despite the advance in resources, despite the advance in wealth, we're still facing similar situations. So what my dad faced in 1972 was coming to a different country when he could speak English, but I assume with a different accent. And obviously he was a brown man in a white country. I came to Czech Republic, a brown man in a white country. And he was an outsider, and he always tells me stories of the places he lodged in, and they would treat him like shit. And there was no community, and he would be doing any sort of odd jobs, any sort of odd bit of work here and there, cleaning up. And then the rest of my dad's side of the family settled there in the next few years. And they were able to quite remarkably build up some sort of... They were able to build lives for themselves in the UK, which I think is one of the most incredible stories, success stories in the UK, which doesn't really get appreciated enough. We talk about immigrants and refugees coming to the UK and to other countries in Europe as well these days. But if we look at the success story, overwhelming success stories of the British Asians who came from Uganda to the UK, one of the most incredibly successful immigrant subsets in the history of the world. Lowest crime rate in the UK and one of the highest education rates, one of the highest rates of doctors and lawyers and all of this sort of thing. So you can say objectively an asset to the United Kingdom, especially with all of the curry houses, even if you don't like looking at brown people.
Yeah, that was a big benefit to the UK, wasn't it?
Well, yeah.
Bringing in some culture to the fish and chip country.
Even if you don't like looking at us, at least you'll eat our food.
So in those 8 years that you were in Czech Republic, Nishant, that's when you started to establish yourself as a cricket journalist. Now, this is quite a competitive field from what we see it as. I don't know, you would know more than us, really. But considering how competitive it is to shine in this field, what made you think that, okay, you know, this is something I want to try? Because I know that in Czech Republic, winters get long, they get boring sometimes, and you need something productive to do, at least to keep your brain stimulated. And this is one reason, well, one of the many reasons why I started this podcast with Ankita and the other things that I do. So is this why you started Alt Cricket?
How did you go from the tiers to cricket?
Yeah, you went from tiers to cricket. That's what happened.
So it feels like almost we're dissecting my life year by year now. I've never had this sort of conversation with anybody before. It's just, you're asking some really deep questions.
Oh, thanks.
It's what we do best.
Yeah, we see that as a compliment.
Amandeep, you listening?
Yeah.
I get that joke because it was an in-joke reference to a previous podcast, and I listen to every podcast religiously. So, look, it's my first year in Czech Republic passed very eventfully. In fact, once again, it was incredibly tough. The winters, as Mino said, were very, very long, and I just passed it by the skin of my teeth. I scraped through it. The last possible exam date that I had, the last possible resit chance that I had, I just about scraped through it by the skin of my teeth. And still to this day, I have to thank that female professor who was known for passing boys who...
wore nice perfume.
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
So on that day, I made sure that I wore my nice perfume and that I just bathed in it. I just sprayed it anywhere. I think I even sprayed my crotch with it. You can never be too careful.
Can we just go back to that? How did anyone find out that was her trick? That was the reason why she was passing?
Actually, that is a good point. How did everyone know Mazarova? Her name is Mazarova, by the way. She's got red hair. I still remember her. She actually hated me in first year. So she wasn't very nice. She's not very nice to girls usually, but with
that's
boys.
That's because you're sporty and you're stanky.
Yeah, probably.
It's just one of those anecdotal things that when you get... So in Czech Republic, as Minos mentioned before, probably every single episode, all of our exams are oral exams. And that does present you with a different challenge. And sometimes professors are a little bit more subjective. And I learned that if you get your exam time, if you manage to get the exam time before lunch, just before lunch, so about 12 o'clock or 12:30, people are getting hangry. And people are just looking to get the most out of their lunch break. So even if I didn't know jack shit, they would end up passing me. Just, oh, yeah, fine. He'll learn it later. He'll learn it later. Let's go and get a sandwich. So there was that give and take. Overall, to be fair, I think it was a very fair system. And yeah, I think it was just anecdotally, we got handed down, you know, from year to year, you get, oh, well, this professor's nice, this professor isn't nice, this professor likes girls, this professor doesn't like giving top marks to girls, and all of that sort of thing. So I hedged my bets and just wore my finest Versace on that day.
So what made you start all cricket then?
Oh, cricket.
Yeah, so we went off on a tangent. But why? I mean, you're a medical student, right? And you spend a lot of... I mean, even in your gap year between Imperial and Czech Republic, that you didn't even pick up a new project then.
Mm.
So what made you start something during a degree, during a time which was quite busy?
Oh, that's... again, that I didn't think about it from that sort of view, to be honest, either. But I think there was sort of an aspect of wanting to make up for lost time. I felt that... I mean, this was coming into my third year now. So my first year, I definitely couldn't do anything because it was just jam-packed non-stop with exams. I had the most
fun first year ever. I don't know what I did.
That's because you were a Duracell bunny.
Yeah, I know Miel was an anomaly, really, in doing so well in her first year and able to manage her running and all of her other outside activities as well. It was very, very impressive. But most people can't do that. And I certainly struggled during my first year just to settle in fact. And that's why I then set up this mentorship system to help people settle in the Czech Republic. And the year that we set it up, that was in my third year when I was trying to do things productive and make things more productive and say, look, this first year has passed me by. I couldn't do anything. Fine. Second year, okay, I had a little bit more spare time, but didn't really achieve anything.
Did you feel settled in second year?
A little bit, yeah. So there was a little bit less pressure, and I didn't have a fantastic time, but I didn't have a terrible time either. So I felt like I wasn't under so much stress. It felt like I could coast through a little bit happily and still not struggle through the exams terribly, terribly. Also, I had the classic sort of teething problems living with other people in my first year. I was with some absolutely terrible housemates, and they were giving me hell as well. And just everything in my first year was just horrible. Settling in a different country, different language, where you don't even know. The first day that I came, I didn't even know how to say, I want bread, I want milk.
You didn't even know where your the closest supermarket was. He didn't even know that he had a supermarket maybe 5 minutes walk away from him. He would travel a good 20 minutes because he didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, to get milk, I remember in my first year, I would go 20 minutes to get...
Wait, can I ask, yeah, like, someone started a logo company at the age of 16,
yeah,
and he couldn't figure out there was a supermarket 5 minutes.
Well, it's obvious.
That's because he was not allowed to cross the road to get milk when he was a child.
He was not for life. He's like, I can't cross the road.
I can't get milk. That's his disability. He can't get milk.
Very funny, guys. And, I mean, somebody said that there was a Tesco 20 minutes away. So that's where I went to get all of the milk. And obviously I wouldn't just buy one bottle of milk. I'd buy as much milk as I could carry, the long life milk. And I'd carry that on the bus. And I'd go out on trips to Tesco just to buy enough milk to last me for like a month.
You told me that your parents used to send you boxes of food, like cheddar cheese. And
yeah.
Wow.
So in that first year, it was such a struggle. And keep in mind, there were no restaurants, no cafes. There was no idea that, okay, well, you're vegetarian, so we can cater to you. Any time that we would eat out, which would be a rarity, to be honest, because everybody was studying so hard all the time.
Or broke.
But mainly studying so hard all the time. We didn't have any concept that we could go out and enjoy ourselves. Going to the cinema, I can't remember ever going to the cinema in my first year. And we would literally just be at home all the time by ourselves, especially because it was so cold. Bloody freezing in the Czech Republic these winters were. And yeah, it was just a massive, massive struggle in that first year. And then getting through to that second year, things became a little bit lighter. Then that third year, I thought, okay, well, my life's a little bit more on track. I want to be more ambitious. I was on the verge of achieving so much. What can I do? And then old cricket started. I'd already been using Twitter informally just to joke around, and because there was some sports forum that I'd been part of earlier on, and then everybody's migrated to Twitter. So I carried that on. And I thought, well, you know what? I want to start something. And then Twitter was right at its infancy, so I was fortunate in that I was riding the crest of the wave. But I set myself the challenge. I said, I want to write a book within 30 days. And I did that.
Is this the write a novella challenge sort of thing that you did, that I'll finish a book in 30 days, or was it just your personal project? Because it's an actual thing where...
No, it was a Nishant Joshi challenge.
Really? Because there is a thing where you write, it's in November every year, and you write a novel in 30 days. It's a thing where you get mentors and they tell you, write 10,000 words a day.
No, it was nothing like that. And ironically, it was the month of November that I did choose. But it was... I mean, I got fed up with cricket writing. Mino had earlier alluded to, cricket writing is very competitive. It's not competitive. Competition is an illusion in a lot of fields. And I think journalism is one where it is a massive illusion as well. There's still a lot of nepotism, a lot of favoritism. And I'm proud to say that I sort of helped break that down for a lot of other people who've since followed. I kept on reading Crickinfo, which is the world's main cricket website, and I kept on reading articles every single day. They were just so repetitive and so disinterested and so banal and so run of the mill. And I was writing a little bit from time to time, and that was a time when people started blogging about cricket, and people were posting things on Twitter, that people were posting links to their blogs on Twitter, so you could find these blogs quite readily, instead of having to search the web for them. They would actually show up on your doorstep and you could access people's blogs, and a couple of them were actually really good. And I thought, well, hang on a sec. This person's blog, and I hate the term blog, by the way, but just for history's sake, I have to use it, really. This person's blog is far better quality than what I'm reading on Crickinfo. Then I'd always been interested in writing. It always been a mild passion of mine. And I'd always enjoyed English classes and English literature classes as well. And I just thought, well, okay, I'll write a bit about cricket now. I'd written a bit for the school newspaper years and years before. And then I started writing a little bit about cricket. I thought, look, I can do this. I know that I'm better than these people in Crickinfo and all of these other websites and newspapers. Who are these old fogies? I'm going to prove that I'm better than them. And that not just I'm better than them, but me and my mates are better than them as well. And so I got a few people around on Twitter as well. And I think there was a group of... I want to say about 15 of us, and we produced about 30 articles. I think I wrote 5 long articles for this book. It was supposed to be a 2 fingers up at the establishment. So the Wisden Almanac is the cricket Bible, known as the Cricket Bible, which is published every year, the Wisden Almanac. So I named my book The Alternative Cricket Almanac 2011. So that was November 2010. Bloody hell, that's a long time ago.
7 years ago.
Yeah, that's why I say it was a long time ago, November 2010. Yeah, okay. Keep up.
Okay, so if someone who's listening to this podcast right now wants to read your work and wants to buy your book, how could they find it?
Well, considering it was 7 years ago, I think the lot it was doing...
Well, Ankit and I purchased it.
Really?
Yeah, it's in the room.
Really?
We got it off Amazon.
Yeah, when Meenal was here in Edinburgh, we just went online. We were like, we're interviewing Nishant, why not just buy his book? And bought it. Realized, it's on Amazon. I wanted you to know that.
And then we realized that we're not so interested in cricket, but it was nice to have the book.
What did you guys...
You know, I opened the page and it said something about bowling at this miles per hour. And I'm like, okay, I'm not interested. But it was nice to have the book there.
But the thing is, the book itself, it wasn't meant to be just about cricket. People were writing about lots of zany things at that time, and there was a really fresh element of satire to it as well. And I think the first page you'll find was by a cricket writer who's now gone on to do really good things, Jared Kimber. He wrote a story about there being a zombie version of Donald Bradman, and it was just so fresh and satirical and so beautiful, and it was a pastiche of so many different themes together. And that was what we were all about. It was a fresh alternative to the establishment.
So if Nishant can't tell you where to buy the books, I'll tell you. You can find it on Amazon.
I don't want anybody to buy the book.
He doesn't want a humble brag.
I don't want anybody to buy the book 7 years on. I think some of it's aged well, but it's quite raw. Yeah.
And Nishant, I know that when you were in Czech Republic, I think it was in your 4th year, you decided to start a cricket team as well.
Mm.
And I know that in Czech Republic, in the winters, cricket won't really work, right? So you only had a couple of months at your disposal to make something out of this. So when the winters are so hot...
When you have your black and white Soviet winters...
Yeah, when you're in the black and white Soviet Union winters, how did you think this would be a good idea? And how do you think this would work? Considering that most students at university can get lazy and maybe not have that drive that you had. And also considering that most years maybe had like 20 students and maybe 5 of them were brown.
So I always liked playing cricket when I was in secondary school, and my dad would take us almost every year to a test match or an ODI when we were younger as well. And there'd be cricket on quite a lot of the time when I was younger, but I never really got the chance to play at a high level. Also, I think this kind of ties into the outsider sort of thing, because my dad, I remember the first day that I was even accepted by, it was the day that I turned up for interview at my secondary school. There were cricket matches being played, and my dad said, "Oh, can my son play? He's really good." And he had to be explained that, well, there's actually a selection process and your son doesn't actually go to the school. And I remember the thing is, it kind of loops back a lot to my dad, because even when I was about 10 years old, he hired a coach to coach me for 2 hours at Lord's.
Wow.
I think the 2 hours cost £100. And it was an old man, and he didn't really coach me much. He just said, "Bat a bit, bowl a bit, and I'll see how you are.
And I'll take your money and leave."
Well, yeah, he didn't really teach me anything. He just said, "You have to bowl in this area and just bat normally." And I wasn't... it's incredible. I think all of this really starting to boil down to my dad even. Because my dad would always say, "Look, just don't get out. Don't get out. Don't lose your wicket. Don't get out." So then throughout my secondary school, I would have a really, really defensive outlook on things. So I would never look to score runs. I would only ever look to bat for a really long time and just not get out. And I didn't have the game awareness or the match awareness of the situation of how to win a game or how to score runs. And I didn't understand that there was a team of players behind me. I didn't know anything. And there were a couple of times where I batted so slowly that I was criticized by the coaches. But then I slowly became a little bit better. I became a really good bowler as well. And that's why I say it was I was a little bit of an outsider. And it's a sort of adjunct to this cricket journalism thing is that Angus Fraser was a very famous English bowler. His brother was coach for our secondary school team, and he'd promised me one day that I would be allowed in the press box of Lord's, in fact, for an England versus Bangladesh ODI. I think that was in 2005, actually. And I bought my first suit for it. I was super excited. And it was just one of my dreams come true. I was so excited. And my dad, I remember in the suit place, Moss Brothers, who spent £100 on my suit.
Really?
My first ever suit. And he said to the salesman, "Oh, well, my son's going to commentate live on TV." And I was like, probably not what's going to happen. And then on the morning that I was supposed to go to Lord's, I get an email. And I still remember it to this day. And this is how impressionable kids can be sometimes. I got an email from his brother saying, "Big sorry, he's forgotten, can't do it this time, maybe next time." And again, I was heartbroken. I can't remember any tears. There may have been some. Knowing me and having listened to me for a little while now, you can probably extrapolate that there may have been some tears. But I mean, imagine.
So we're on chapter of The Tears Have Returned.
No, the name of the book is The Tears of Nishant Joshi. So we're in the...
Oh, we're still in Soviet Union. Yeah, sorry.
So again, it was another moment where I'd just been let down and incredibly gutted. And so that's why at the back of my mind, I always had this extra motivation to prove people wrong and say, "Look, you didn't help me get into this press box. I had to do it all by myself. And look where I am now." And I've never met either of them, despite having been in school and having been in lots of press boxes since. I've not come across either of them, but I really would like to bring that back up to them.
Well, hopefully you'll meet Professor Chan in the same way one day.
I don't know what would happen if I saw him, but yeah, it was definitely a motivational figure of hate for quite a while. But so, you're talking about the cricket team specifically. I just wanted to do something, and with Alt Cricket, I got some sponsorship. There was a lovely cricket shop called It's Just Cricket, which was from a friend of a friend who'd recommended and very happily supported us. Sent over £1,000 worth of kit, and then I started training everybody how to play cricket. And I set up East Czech Republic's first ever cricket club.
What was it called? Hurricane?
It was called the Hradec-Králové Hurricanes.
Oh, and then when I was in my second year, Ankita, so this is when Nishant was in his final... No, this is when Nishant was in his fifth year. In my first year, in the summer semester, we started a girls' team. And we were called the Hrad... Like, what were we called?
Maybe the heroines or something?
Yeah, something like that.
This was your cricket team. You don't even know what you were called.
Actually, surprisingly, we got a lot of girls on board. And they weren't just brown girls. There were German girls, Norwegian girls. And in fact, it was when the Norwegian girls and the German girls were much more interested than the brown girls, I think, to play. And Nishant was a very good coach. And a lot of us stayed over 2 hours playing. Mm. And Nishant really established a really good ground for cricket. Unfortunately, after he left, it kind of dissolved because no one was there to take it up. But from what I saw, I think he did a very good job.
And you said that you wrote your book with some other people that you found on Twitter. And it was while you were writing the book that you came up with the name The Alternative Cricket Almanac. So was your Twitter handle always Alt Cricket while you were getting in touch with?
It started off as the Alt Almanac. That was the original Twitter handle. It only turned... And that was to promote the book, actually. That was the only reason why I had a Twitter page in the first place, really, about cricket. It was just to promote the book. So I'd make some jokes, but it would all loop back to the book. And then over the next few months, it became more of a permanent thing. Then I said, well, just branding-wise, it makes more sense to just call it Old Cricket.
So anyone from India who follows cricket on Twitter knows that this Twitter account of yours, Alt Cricket, it actually kind of blew up with all the followers that you gained. You had close to 100,000 followers there. And, you know, Desi Outsiders has been around for 10 months and we just have about 300 followers on Twitter. So can you just share your words of wisdom with us? How did you gain this kind of following from scratch?
I think it's just about having incredibly good hair.
Was there any
product that I use?
No.
Yeah, I use 3 different products in my hair. Thank you for...
And that's what... And actually, just to let everyone know, he was about 40 minutes late every class every morning. But was there any...
Totally worth it.
But was there any sort of process behind... Did you have a plan in your head? Or it was just, well, I'm going to do this... I'm going to do something that I love, something that is fun to do, and then...
And obviously, the name of the Twitter handle was like a PR campaign for your book. But to gain followers on Twitter, did you have a PR process?
No, there was nothing of the sort. And especially in the first few months, I was closing the blog down because I'd written a few satirical pieces to just support the book. And I published some pieces from the book on the website and linked to them via Twitter and just tried to banter with other people. And I mean, after a few months, we'd sold a few hundred copies and the proceeds were meant to go to the Afghan Cricket Youth Support Organization. That's another thing that I can claim credit for. I was totally more into Afghan cricket than all of these bandwagon jumpers now who come along years and years later. But it was thanks to a group of bloggers raising awareness a few years ago that Afghan cricket actually started to really come out.
Well, you must have been very proud to see them, this IPL.
I was very, very proud. I mean, you see young stars like Rashid Khan, the young leg spinner, just doing so well now, and another IPL star, Mohammed Nabi, both playing for the Sunrisers. It makes me feel very, very proud to see both of them succeed. But, I mean, you're asking about Alt cricket and how it carried on. It was just a series of flukes. It was during the IPL of that year, 2011 IPL.
But you can't, I mean, if a little kid came up to you and said, like, this, I want to do something similar to what you've done, you wouldn't say, oh, it will just be flukes. Surely there has to be some process, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Twitter and social media have been constantly evolving thing, and there have been so many restrictions being put on and so many algorithms put on now that it's quite difficult to keep up. And all I can say that I was quite fortunate that I was riding a crest of the wave where it was a purely meritocratic environment. So if you were good, if you were funny, then you could rise to the top. And that's how I can actually say, that's why I actually have some pride. Because I didn't get a leg up. Nobody helped me ever. It was just through me being...
witty?
Well, other people finding me... I don't want to say attractive. What's a better word than attractive? Other people following me and then saying, hey, you should follow this guy. He's funny. He knows what he's talking about. Mm. And that was why I became better. Although, the main thing was the IPL cheerleader issue.
Okay, clearly he wants to talk about that. So can you tell us about this IPL cheerleader issue? Angita does not know about it.
Oh, right. Okay, so then it's probably worth talking about because I think there's a great quote from one of my favorite artists, Julian Casablancas, who's the lead singer of The Strokes. He said, if you work hard enough, you'll eventually experience the happy accidents that are art. And I think that translates a lot with any sort of creative activity, because if you paint a painting or write a song, you can't say that this is definitely going to be a hit, because if you write an article even, or if you record a podcast, even if you think you've recorded the best podcast of all time, it doesn't necessarily correlate to it having the highest number of hits. And certainly that's what I found in my podcast as well. I really do believe in these happy accidents being the product of hard work. And I'm sure there are lots of other happy accidents in between old cricket, but it really was purely birthed from this happy accident, which happened in 2011 spring. I think it was the third season of the IPL, where one of my followers had tweeted at me and said, look, my sister is going to the IPL. She's going to be a cheerleader there. She's from South Africa. Would you like to have a blog from her? And I said, yeah, sure. That sounds okay. I mean, I was very ambivalent about it. I'd stopped posting on the blog by then. I just wasn't very interested in continuing. I thought, okay, well, we've had a nice flicker of the flame. I just thought, well, look, we've had a nice little run. We've made our point. They know we're here. I'll just get on with my life. And then she'd written a couple of blogs for us. Back then, the IPL parties were very much in vogue. And I can indirectly claim credit for the IPL parties going out of fashion. In fact, I've ruined a lot of fun for a lot of cricketers in the last few years. And she'd written a couple of blogs for us, very nice lady called Gabriella from South Africa. And they were kind of innocent, said, oh, at this party, this cricketer said hi to me. Sort of below the radar, low-key, vaguely gossipy, but not really outrageous stuff at all. Nothing was salacious. And then one day she sent me a message saying, Nishant, they've just sent me home. I'm at the airport and I'm on the plane back to South Africa. And I said, God, what's happened? And then she explained that one of the cricketers who had been playing away from home, so to say, I mean, that works on a couple of different levels, but he had a fiance or something like that, and he'd done something at a nightclub which he shouldn't have done, or something along those lines. She knew about it, and he became really scared that she was going to out him. So he reported it to the IPL commissioner, and the IPL commissioner said, no, you can't have this. Again, another common theme, fuck off and get out.
Mm.
And what happened then? She told me about it, and it's only then that a fuss happened. And I say this now as well, because, I mean, I didn't have any bone to pick with anybody. I didn't even care how many hits the piece got. I mean, it was no skin off my nose. It was just a little bit of gossip that I felt I was doing a little bit of a favour to a cheerleader who just wanted to write a bit of a diary for. And she, poor girl, got sent home, a contract terminated, kicked out of the country, went to South Africa, back to South Africa, and suddenly word just shot around, because the IPL was especially so big in those younger days as well. People were really hot on that sort of gossip, because it was the perfect blend of Bollywood drama and, oh, who done it, and who was the cricketer who did this, and what had the cheerleader observed, and what were the Indian cricketers like at all these parties, and who was there, who was doing what. And so people were really getting into the masala of it, and there was all of this drama behind it. And so then I started getting phone calls from +91 extensions when I was in pathology lectures in my third year. Then I was stepping out of my pathology lectures to answer questions on NDTV and all of these other Indian channels. And they asked me sometimes point blank, who was the cricketer? And I said, look, I can't answer that. I'm trying to be a doctor. I'm not trying to be a gossip fucking columnist. And even though it would have got me even more traction, I'm sure, if I just started to say to Gabriella, the cheerleader, okay, we can really go big on this together. Oh, it didn't even cross my mind.
So that situation blew up your Twitter account, and it blew up your popularity with all cricket. But now we know that all cricket is no more. RIP all cricket. It's really sad to say. So what actually happened then, Nishan? I know that you got banned from Twitter because of a tweet.
Yeah, it's all another kickoff, just fuck off and stay out situation, really.
So did any tears return at this point?
No, this time there were no tears.
Oh, very happy for you.
But I posted a tweet about Virat Kohli. It was very funny. It was very
it was proved to be deliciously ironic, because it was a joke about how Virat Kohli fans are very sensitive and just worship Virat Kohli for no good reason, even though he's a bit arrogant and he could be a lot better as a human being. And as a role model, because again, we talk about being impressionable, he's now made his army of kid fans just incredibly impressionable. They saw it, they reported me for that tweet, then the smarter ones found tweets from when I was studying in Czech Republic. They searched for lots of previous tweets and they realized that I posted a few tweets to now defunct websites. When people would say to me in the middle of the night, oh, so you're watching West Indies versus Zimbabwe. Have you got a stream to that? Because I didn't have a TV in Czech Republic and no TV channel showed cricket anyway. So I would just be live tweeting cricket from watching it on illegal, so-called illegal streams on my laptop. I mean, it's a bit ridiculous to think that cricket can be illegal if you're watching it, especially then publicizing it like I was. But these links were deemed to be in breach of copyright, and because they were from years and years ago, and because so many people reported me for the same one, I just got lots and lots of strikes against my name, and that's all she wrote. There is no recovery, and that's the end of the road for alt cricket, and I'm now very much at peace with it.
But the alt cricket brand sort of continues to live, and it does not only represent cricket and journalism at this point, because the Alt Cricket Foundation is a charity that I'm sure quite a lot of people have already heard of. So can you tell us a little bit about this charity under your name?
This does revert back to the influencing of people. And I discovered that the more followers that I gained, the more influential I was becoming. And this is why I hate when people say, oh, I'm just a cricketer, I'm not a role model, or I'm just a rapper, I'm not a role model. No, if you're in the public eye, you have an influence on people, whether you like it or not. You have a form of soft power from a wider cultural point of view as well. You're contributing to the conversation. So especially once I started getting to about 20,000 followers and people were saying, oh, thank you, you actually inspired me to become a medical student. You inspired me to become a cricket writer. Well, I didn't intentionally inspire anybody to do anything. I didn't. There was no intention ever. But certainly after I did a couple of charity trips and a couple of charitable fundraising events, especially for a charity called Cricket Without Boundaries, I went to Kenya with a fantastic charity called Cricket Without Boundaries. I think that was 2012. And after then, I tweeted about them saying fundraising, and I raised some money for the charity through there. And after that, people started saying, oh, you know what? Thanks to you, I've actually been on this trip and it's changed my life. And then I realized, look, well, whether I like it or not, I've got this influence. I might as well try to influence people for the good, especially because previously, as I've explained, I've been influenced for the worse. People have contributed to bad experiences in my life, which took years and years to erase and overcome just through glib off-the-cuff remarks.
And what's the All Cricket Foundation currently doing?
So again, it comes down to what I was saying about influencing people. I mean, I really wanted to start alt cricket, developing alt cricket as a platform for good. So as I matured as a person, I wanted alt cricket, the entity, to mature as well. And I wanted my audience to mature with me. And I wanted people who were younger than myself to start doing charitable things where possible. So our motto was, and still is, do good and have a bloody good time doing it. Which is why alt cricket was always having a lot of fun and essentially harmless fun and trying to promote good causes. Like we did the Kilimanjaro climb a few years ago as well, which raised over £200,000. Now we see the stadium in Rwanda being built, in fact, which is a massive, massive milestone. But the current project that we're doing, and essentially the first major project of alt cricket's own back, is the orphanage thing that we're building in Western Kenya. So we're hoping to raise £20,000 in the next few months to build a full orphanage for 12 children between the ages of 5 and 14. And right now they've got a bit of a shanty hut situation going on where we're caring for them informally. And I've been paying out my own salary for their clothing and food and education over the past couple of years. And now we really want to formalize it and build a safe space where these orphans can really build new lives for themselves.
So one thing that came out of All Cricket was the All Cricket Foundation, but we also know that Radio Cricket came about as well. And from the very beginning, James was, well, I don't know, was James part of Radio Cricket from the very beginning?
And yeah, he was.
He was. So we know that you both lived in the same country. And Ankita, this will be an interesting story for you. And that is that Nishant only met James 2 years into their podcast, and they lived in the same country. I met you maybe 6 months after, and I flew to you.
We've been friends for 18 months, and I think we have a 6 month thing where we
see each other.
Meet up.
And I was just telling Nisha on that day, Ankita and I lived in the same country. I would be at her place every other weekend.
Yeah.
So what was your relationship with James like, and why is he not in the picture so much these days?
My relationship with James was very fiery and at some points sexual. Hey, you want the truth.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
They'll be surprised. We just had a lot in common. We met through Twitter. Sorry, we met through Grindr. And we had a lot of things in common. We were both expats in the Czech Republic. We lived 2 hours apart. But as Minal said, we only met each other a long time into our friendship. I don't really know why. I think it was both of us were just happy talking to each other over the phone. And
I can totally relate to that.
And very socially, maybe a bit shy in that way as well, meeting up with the other person. And we just had a lot in common. We loved satire. And we loved bringing politics into cricket as well. And we had, for about 2 or 3 years, we worked together just about every week religiously, just like how yourself and Ankita are doing
so
it. How you two were clearly inspired by us. I wouldn't say copycat, but clearly inspired by
the duo.
but at least we don't share a sexual relationship.
Who says that's a bad thing? Get involved, mate.
So did
who's stopping you? God. You guys are supposed to be about taboo busting. Jesus, you're so bloody repressed when it comes down to it.
I'm married to a man.
So, Nishan, you've done a lot of radio and television journalism for big names like Star Sports. In fact, you picked up a gig right after you graduated with Star Sports in the UK. Do you think radio cricket really helped you get to that stage more than alt cricket?
So both, essentially, they were part of the same umbrella, to be fair. Mm. So everything was contributing towards this end product. I never hoped that I would have a TV show or anything like that. I did do a TV show pilot called Spot the Googly, which was a cricket quiz show, which I still think is one of the best things ever recorded in cricket TV, but still that hasn't been picked up 3 or 4 years later.
Well, you had a show on The Wisden, didn't you?
That was a YouTube show.
Okay.
And again, not fantastic production quality as well.
Mm.
I mean, radio cricket did help, but I was trying to develop myself
as an all-rounder, right?
This is where what I was saying about being well-rounded before, and then I tried to put myself in the deep end, and that's what Czech Republic taught me. When I came to Czech Republic, friendless, familyless, penniless, clothesless,
girlfriendless,
homeless,
milkless,
breadless.
Okay, I think we get the point. So,
But that was the big learning point for me. Being thrown into the deep end was something that I didn't want to do when I was younger because my parents were so averse to it. They said, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. Things will take care of themselves. And then it reached the point where I said, no, I've got to take responsibility for my own self. I'm going to struggle and I'm going to suffer, and that's the only way I'm going to learn. And even now, when they're sending new doctors to me to train, I'm telling them that without suffering, you're not going to prosper in any job at all.
So, Nishan, it looks like these days you've taken a step back from all these gigs. Is it because of your medical career? And in fact, actually, in the next decade, do you see yourself as a medical practitioner or a sports journalist?
Again, I think it revolves around being not wishing to be pigeonholed for a specific time period as well. I think I showed that during medical school, I could do a lot of things at once and to a reasonably high standard. And so that I have been put in these lots of difficult situations over the past 5 or 10 years. And eventually I've come out of them with some degree of success. I was on my knees at one point, and now I'm still on my knees sometimes, but there are less tears these days. There are fewer tears.
I won't ask what you're doing on your knees.
And you just celebrated your 29th birthday last week, so belated happy birthday on our podcast, Nishan.
Thanks, that means a lot.
That's almost the age when, you know, again, the Desi aunties and uncles want to know if you're planning to, quote-unquote, settle down soon. So I'm no different. I think we already established that I'm not different from a Desi auntie myself, and I'm quite curious to know what your answer to that question would be. Do you have a girlfriend? Are you planning to get married soon?
Well, it's not that I'm 29 and people are asking me these things. They've been asking me these things since I was 14. So since I was 14, they wanted me to get married and settle down and have a job and all of these sorts of things.
And be the president and be a millionaire.
Yeah, and since I really started to become more independent and started to do things for myself, I've understood that I have to triage the influence of certain people, whether it's even family members or close family friends or whoever it is. And I understand that I have my own deeply cross-checked and regularly checked value system. And in fact, my secret trick that I tell all of my close friends and the medical students that I've mentored is that during your time, just keep a diary of all of the really good and really bad things that happen and all the learning points. And so I've kept that as a sort of reference to see how my behavior has evolved over the past few years and to see whether it's becoming more consistent and to whether I'm treating people better, essentially. That's all that I want to do. Make sure that I'm treating people, as many people as I can, as well as I can. Whether it's my patients, whether it's the granny on the street who can't, who needs a hand to get home, whether it's mum or dad or my family, whoever, I just want to help people. And I know that sounds really corny, but I think once you become a doctor, and I think working in the hospital environment just really changes you. Once you become a doctor or you observe nurses picking up shit. I mean, I said, yeah, I say that, but literally the other day I was saying that as captain of my Saturday cricket team, I picked up dog shit off the field so that people could play. And that's something that a few years ago, if I hadn't been a doctor, then I probably would have shied away from it. But I really, it felt like nothing to me because I felt like I had to do something small for the great of the good. I don't know if that comes across as something.
But is that how this book is ending?
No, you're allowed to say that after all the tears, I think. It's a nice way to end your lovely novella story.
That's what I was saying. Is that how the book is ending? Like, from tears to dog shit?
You can't end it on dog shit. You can't end on that.
That's how you...
You can't end it on that. Ask me another question, jeez.
So on that Desi Auntie note, Nishant, we've reached the end of the conversation. So thank you so much for joining us this week. It's been a pleasure. And it's your fault that you still spoke about the dog shit. Like, we had no questions further than that. That's how you ended it. So thank you once again, Alt Cricket.
And now that the Alt Cricket's Twitter account is suspended, sorry for bringing that up once again, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they go about that?
I'm essentially uncontactable, and it's great. I don't want any contact from anybody. But
okay. Okay, so
if somebody does want to get in touch, then they can always tweet me at Radio Cricket, and I'll eventually pick up a message. Or you can get in touch with you guys, and you guys have my... Yeah, that's the best way. How about
no, people's... don't bring them to us. We don't want any cricket fans coming to us.
We don't want more people telling us that they could relate to the tears and the dog shit.
Yeah.
So thank you so much once again, Nishant, for coming on the show. It's been quite a lot of fun, especially since you're a friend first and a guest second.
Thank you, Ankita, and thank you very much, Meal. It's been a pleasure to listen to 40 podcast episodes and be part of this two-part series. I've never had such an in-depth conversation with anybody before. Hopefully I get the chance to interview both of you and cross-examine you next time as well.
You won't get as good as us at the professional stalking thing.
That is true.
You're the Desi Aunties, but you're also judge, jury, and bloody executioners as well. Jesus. Judgy McJudgersons.
And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us on this second part of the interview with Nishant Joshi. And thank you, Nishant, for leaving your patience and giving us your precious time. If you have any questions for Nishant, you can find him at Radio Cricket on Twitter.
And you can follow us on social media at Desi Outsiders. You can also drop in a mail with your thoughts, feedback, or questions to mail@desioutsiders.com. And as always, please rate and review the Desi Outsiders podcast on iTunes and tell all your friends about us.
So until next week, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And we are the Desi Outsiders.